After the first purposely scheduled 14 days of action at the All England Club, it came down to two of the most dynamic, polarising, talented and passion-filled personalities on the men's tour to battle it out for the Wimbledon singles titles. And it's a battle we'll be talking about for many years to come. Hello, I'm Chris Bowers. Welcome to this week's ATP podcast, summing up the 2022 Wimbledon Championships. And I'm once again joined by the former WTA player Jill Krabus and the commentator Peter McCarto. We'll look back on the final, the rest of the tournament, and we'll be hearing from the Australian legend John Newcombe. We'll be talking to Facundo Lugones, the man who coached Cam Norrie to a semi-final appearance here. And also we'll be talking to this year's Wimbledon doubles runners-up Nikola Mektic and Matej Pavic. But first of all, let's look back on the final we've just been privileged to have seen in the flesh. Novak Djokovic beating Nick Kyrgios in four sets. I know it's not anything new. It's a seventh title. It's a 21st Grand Slam title. But we do live in the most remarkable era. And Jill, he was the best player in the tournament.
He was. Well, definitely at the end, for sure. I think there were moments throughout the 2 weeks, right, that maybe he started off well and then maybe had a little bit of a slip in, some people would say, in a couple of his matches. But the thing about those matches where he was down two sets to love against Sinner, lost the first set against Norrie, the point of it was he finished strong. And I think Djokovic is one of the best at being able to take momentum from that if you finish a match strong. And he carried it over into the finals today. And Kyrgios, I thought, played an amazing first set. I don't even think Djokovic played that poorly. Kyrgios came out firing on all cylinders, and it was Djokovic that had to lift his level. And I do feel like Djokovic couldn't get a handle or a read on a lot of Kyrgios' serves in the beginning, as one of the best returners in the men's game. But he started to find that. He started to pick that up. And I think for me, that was the key for him to be able to turn that around.
I had a sense the moment Djokovic came back from love 40 down when serving for the second set, 5-4, to hold serve, to win the second set, I just thought, from this point on, unless Kyrgios serves absolutely lights out and has one really good return game in two sets, there's no way Djokovic will lose this match.
Yeah, the remarkable thing, I think, the two times they met, that Djokovic actually hadn't broken Kyrgios until today, until the match. So, yeah, that's the thing with Novak. He was so calm all the way through. He knew exactly what he needed to do. He returned well. He served. Yeah, it was okay. You know, he did enough to get through, obviously. And as you say, stood up in those key moments. But, you know, all over, he just had worked out Kyrgios by the end and worn him down. And this is the thing, he's so experienced in these situations that he knows exactly what he needs to do at what time and when to just amp up the pressure and when to just sort of, you know, cycle through service games. And he did it beautifully again. It's interesting because so many generations have tried to come through and we're still waiting for that wave to sort of come over the top.
It was fascinating listening to Kyrgios in his post-match press conference because he said, look, Novak didn't do anything special. He was just so composed. Kyrgios said, I served brilliantly. I could not have served better than that. And yet the guy just was so composed and he did everything he had to.
Well, I think that's the brilliance of Djokovic is he doesn't look like he's doing anything special, right? I mean, and there's such contrasting styles between him, Nadal, and Federer. And you have Federer, who's so elegant and comes to the net and has so much variety. Nadal, who's just a grinder and a fighter with the heavy spin and just the intensity. And Djokovic, just so steady. So it doesn't necessarily seem like flashy play or brilliance, but that's what's so amazing about him is he's so rock solid in every part of his game. Okay, maybe the overhead sometimes he can miss and get shaky on, but so rock solid everywhere, especially mentally. I mean, he believes that he's going to win, and you can see it happening in the middle of a match. He just somehow is able to get dig down and just not make a mistake for the rest of the match. Is incredible.
If you're picking up a few extraneous sounds, it sounds like a pop star. Well, this is Djokovic, actually. He's still doing his interviews after the men's singles final. There are plenty of people around looking to cheer him. Either that or they've found a couple of Tunisians that slept on a bench last night. But, I mean, I think that's the nature of him. Kyrgios was talking in his press conference about Federer is the one of the three that makes you feel small because he makes you feel like you can't play tennis. Whereas today, he said, I just felt like I lost to a better player.
Well, you also, I feel like with Djokovic, you also don't get the sense that there's an opening sometimes. You play, like for Kyrgios, just talking about the match in particular, the first set, there were a few very, very long points, and Kyrgios played the long points really well. But you have to be able to sustain that throughout, knowing you have to sustain that throughout a 3-5 set match. can be daunting in your head. And I think Djokovic started playing longer and longer and longer points as the match went on. There were maybe a few in the first set, and he started picking up on the Nick's serve as well, which was huge. He just kept getting so many balls back in play. And then you start to think, what do I have to do to crack through this guy? And he started handling the pace better. And it's just that slight difference as the match goes along that can apply that added pressure.
It's interesting. A lot of people were talking beforehand about the pressure on Djokovic, given that he may not be able to play another major until next year's Roland Garros. I suspect he will be allowed to play in Australia because he's got an appeal against the 3 years that he's supposed to stay outside Australia following the deportation. But I can't see the Biden administration changing its mind on the rule that you have to be double vaccinated to get into America, at least not before the US Open. So he's going to have to miss that. And yet he handled this as if there was no pressure at all.
Yeah, he did incredibly well. And you make a good point. I can't see the U.S. changing their mind right now as far as him being able to play the U.S. Open. But we were talking about this earlier with some of my colleagues about, even though Djokovic is 35 years old, I mean, he acts like he's like 25 to 28. And you just feel like he has the sense that he has at least 5 to 6 years left over with the way he manages his body, how fit he is, never gets tired. And so if you think about just the U.S. Open and Australian Open, I mean, that's only really like a 6 to 8 month period that he might not be able to play. And so he still has quite a bit of time. I don't know if that relieves pressure at all. We know Djokovic is one of the best that can handle pressure 100%. He's shown it over and over again. So I don't think he's the type of guy that thinks ahead like that. He is very good at being in the moment at where he is. And so it did not surprise me at all the way that he was be able to handle this pressure, if he even thought it, he felt like it was pressure.
So Djokovic ends up with the title, but this has been as much about Kyrgios as anything else. Peter, did you get the sense that the ranting that Kyrgios was doing, in particular during the third set, did that spoil the clear maturity that's happened this week? Or was it two steps forward, one step back, or what?
It felt like that, because you looked at the first set and saw how well he played without actually having to do any of that sort of stuff. I think we lost a bit of the ranting at the umpire and lines people. I think that's a good thing, but obviously to his team. And you think, gosh, if he just pulls that back just a little bit, we can focus on the tennis rather than actually talking about all the other stuff around
him. But do you think he fears that if he pulls that back, he might lose some of his sharpness as a player?
Potentially, but I think it's just how you actually do that and try and find the happy medium between the two. I mean, look, one of the more fearsome tasks, I think, is sitting in the Nick Kyrgios player box, because you get yelled at the whole time for stuff you haven't done. But it also showed the pressure, because he thought, you know, it was a big shot of winning this match, and the pressure does strange things to people, and particularly for him too, and it's the box that cop it. But you know, that I still want to spend a lot of time talking about the tennis, because he played so well in that first set and really, you know, didn't play a bad match against a guy who's been here so many times before. And I think the evolution has come from the fact that, you know, yes, he believed. He's talked in press about how, you know, he did put in the preparation, did do the hard yards to get ready for this, and he got the result. And so hopefully he can take that, have a bit of a break, obviously, but take that and go, right, this is where I need to be, because we've seen the tennis, we've seen the fans come through the gates, we've seen all of that sort of stuff. It's just little things on the side. We tone them down, and then we've got the, you know,
I mean,
we
want it both ways, don't we? I mean, the guy's box office, and yet you have to say on a human level, some of the things he was saying, even to his box, even to people who are paid, that's not a great example for youngsters about how to treat people you work with respect.
I mean, I don't love it. I don't really love to, you know, support that behavior. I think it's his way of dealing with pressure, which it is my opinion on it. I think that's how he handles
but
the pressure.
Would you trade that? Supposing he reined it in so he was less interesting, would you prefer that? Or would actually, given that we're all part of the tennis community, do we love having someone like Kyrgios, even if, like McEnroe, like Agassi in his early years, he does actually do things that we really can't condone?
You know, look, I'm not trying to take away his character or personality or anything. I just think you can choose different words, maybe the way you express yourself, and be more respectful to your box, to the umpire. I'm not trying to change his personality, because you're not going to. And I think a lot of people like his character. But when you start if lashing out at your support team, who is there supporting you the whole time, or the umpire, that I don't necessarily love.
No, I think a lot of us feel that way. we have here an Englishman, an American and an Australian presenting this week's ATP podcast. But let's hear from another Australian, the legend John Newcombe. We wanted to get his insightful views on Nick Kyrgios. And I started by asking him what he makes of the mercurial Wimbledon finalist, both as a player and a person.
It's interesting how things develop, isn't it? You know, he just got past his first round, 7-5 of the fifth, and went from strength to strength from there. And, I mean, he's been serving unbelievably and hitting his ground strokes great. So it's been a fight, but, you know, he's worked his way into the final, and it's great to see.
It would be easy to say, oh, yes, well, another chapter in the Australian greats. But when he was asked about the Australian greats, he was somewhat critical before the final of the... He said that apart from Leighton Hewitt, a lot of them have been critical of him, which he saw as a bit of a disappointment. Do you think that he is wanting it too much uncritical support?
Look, I can't speak for, you know, a lot of the other guys, but in speaking to the ones that I, you know, do talk to, with, you know, reasonably regularly, Emo and Rocket and Roche and all that, I mean, we're all think his tennis is great. Never criticise his tennis at all. So it's just sometimes when he, you know, hasn't behaved great on the court, we felt that not only is he letting himself down, but the image of I don't know, Australian tennis is maybe gets let down a little bit, but no one's certainly been critical of his tennis and his ability as a great young sportsman. Nick's his own character, his own man, and he's doing things his way. I think he's probably had some, you know, tough times with all the adulation and all that. It's pretty heady stuff out there, and especially now because he's so involved with social media and all that, so there's a lot of pressure on you. But I think when you get involved with social media, you put a lot of pressure on yourself too, with expectations and things going back and forth.
Do you think that, given that we've had Agassi, we've had McEnroe, do you think that he has perhaps wanted more help from the previous generations of Australian players to help him to the stage he's at now, which he's only reached at 27?
No, I don't think what anyone did or said, you know, during Nick's career was going to make much difference. I think it's a little bit like he said now. He doesn't have a coach. He said he wouldn't put that on anyone to coach him. He's not coachable. But if you listen closely at how he talks to himself on the court, it becomes very apparent that, you know, he's very he knows what's happening out there. He knows what he should be doing. That's when he's talking about his tennis out there. And I think he's got a great knowledge of his game, and I think he reads the game very well. So therefore his anticipation of the other players' shots is excellent.
Do you remember when he beat Nadal 8 years ago? What were you thinking then?
Well, I was commentating on that match, and he was terrific and didn't put a foot wrong. Didn't say anything wrong. He just went out and played unbelievable tennis. Maybe that happened so quick that he got so much thrust on him. And we have a thing in Australia called the Newcombe Medal. And I awarded that to him at the end of the year, you know, because of his performances during the year. Couldn't have been more proud to give it to him. So, yeah, look, he's doing it his way. And maybe one or two guys have come out and being ultra critical of him, and that's just how life is.
It's a good time for Australian tennis at the moment. Just as we lose Ash Barty from the women's side, there's Kyrgios. There's also a real surge in doubles. Kyrgios and Kokkinakis won the Australian Open in an all Australian Open doubles final. Ebden and Purcell, the beaten finalists, have gone all the way this time at Wimbledon. Does that give you extra satisfaction as somebody who played singles and doubles?
Yeah, it does. I mean, when you talk about doubles, you're bringing up something that's a bit of a sore point with me, because it's just a pity to see doubles, you know, none of the top players competing in doubles. It's 90% of players who play tennis around the world play more doubles than singles. So I understand best of five sets the top players don't want to play. But as far as doubles go, I would like to see them having to play more doubles in the regular tournaments where it's two out of three sets. But yes, it's great to see Aussies doing well in the doubles, because we've always had such a great tradition of good doubles players.
Yeah, I mean, in your day, you'd play a best of five singles, you then play a best of five doubles, and you might have to play mixed on the same day. Kyrgios and Kokkinakis pulled out of the doubles at Wimbledon after one round because they said they were worried about the length of matches. Do you think that's reasonable in today's tennis?
Well, yeah, I can only go on my experiences. And in a number of the tournaments that we played during the year, you get through to the final and you play best of five sets in singles. And Rochi and I travelled together a lot, would play one another five-set singles match, and then hour and a half later we'd go on and play the doubles final, best of three sets. So to us it was just normal to do that. Maybe we played more matches than the guys do today. Not that they're not very fit, but maybe we were more match fit to do that sort of thing. I think when all the prize money went up and up and up and there was so much prize money in singles, perhaps guys didn't feel a need to play doubles.
Would you be in favour of Wimbledon reducing the men's doubles to best of three?
I don't think that's going to make any difference to the top players playing. I mean, they've made a decision, you know, they're not going to play, whether it's two out of three or whatever. So keep it best of five.
The voice of John Newcombe. I suppose we ought to make the point that John's opinions are his own, as are the opinions of Peter, Jill and me, and they're not necessarily those of the ATP, but we like to create discussion and that requires different opinions. Jill Kravis and Peter Mercato still with me. Do you agree with John Newcombe that men's doubles at Wimbledon should keep the best of five format?
I am sort of going towards the opinion of the two out of three sets. I think it would encourage maybe singles player to play more doubles if they want to. They might not want to. But
well, that was John's view, that I just if you like change the format, they still wouldn't play.
Well, you don't know. We don't know, right? I mean, because sometimes they do play at certain events. But I don't know. I feel like it's a lot. And I don't have an amazing reason for it. I just feel like I like the two out of three sets.
I was quite pleased to have the chance to put to John Newcombe, Peter, the idea that Kyrgios was less than pleased about the support he's had from the Australian greats. And John there, he was saying, look, there's nothing wrong with his tennis. We love his tennis. All the great Australians love Kyrgios' tennis. It's his behaviour. And he did talk about Kyrgios letting down the reputation of Australian tennis. As somebody who works in Australian tennis at both media and club level, running a tennis club on the edge of Melbourne, do you actually feel that Kyrgios lets down the reputation of Australian tennis?
Well, it's a tricky one, because my philosophy on it is that when he's out here playing, he represents himself. He doesn't represent Australia. We just need to be, you know, jumping on his back about, oh, I let down Australia. No, let down himself, really. It's his career and what he wants to do with it. For me, it's just the example that you set with kids are watching that, and that's where I think the toning it down needs to come into it.
Well, two players who both represented themselves and enhanced the reputation of Australia were Matt Ebden and Max Purcell. They were runners-up at the doubles at the Australian Open. They went one better here. They put out the defending champions, Nikola Mektic and Matej Pavic, in a 4-hour, 11-minute final. Went to a final set tiebreak. They were twice a set down. They were 4-2 down in the fifth, and yet they came back.
Yeah, most of their matches were five sets, actually, throughout the tournament. They had to save a whole heap of match points. I think they had two separate matches, five in the semi-final, and then, they've had to stave them off. Amazing story. Finalists at the Australian Open and now Wimbledon championships, champions. And a shout-out, too, to Matej Pavic, who was playing clearly injured. For a man who has a two-handed backhand, not being able to use one of those hands and having to play one-handed and take it the distance, wow, that was something else. But well done to the Aussies, and well done to Matt Ebden too, because he was in the mixed as well.
Yes, he lost the mixed doubles final. He and Sam Stosur lost to Neil Skupski and Desiree Kravchik, who did what Mektic and Pavic couldn't do. They defended their title.
They did. First time since 96-97 with the mixed doubles too. So it's been a little while, but good to see that they actually do back up and play, because we so rarely see the mixed doubles on the tour these days.
And the women's singles, Elena Rybakina, a great achievement for her. I don't want to deny her her moment, but for me, the bigger significance in world tennis was Ons Jabeur getting to the final. That is massive for both Africa and the Arab world.
Absolutely, yeah. I think, you know, that's been a lot of the talk of the tournament is Ons Jabeur and that mantle that she's taken on and how well she's just been able to accept that and be such a role model for so many people around the world. I think that's definitely something we need to touch on, because she is very popular here. She's got a lot of fans out here. She's getting messages from her region of the world, inspiring kids everywhere. So that is definitely something that we need to focus on and pay attention to. But Rybakina, what an unbelievable performance. I think even a semifinal against Halep, the way she came out and just took the match in her hands and played so exceptionally well. And to be able to come out in both of these, their first moment ever in a final of a Grand Slam, I thought they both handled it exceptionally well. I think both of them, I'm sure, were a little bit nervous. I think Rybakina more so in the beginning. Ons Jabeur came out firing, was super hyped up. And the way Rybakina was able to settle herself and turn that around, it was a nice match. And I love to see the embrace at the end and the appreciation for each other.
Yeah, I recently talked to the head of development in tennis for the International Tennis Federation in North and West Africa. And he was saying, we are raising levels in Africa. We really are doing an awful lot. But the rest of the world is raising its level too. And it's so difficult for somebody from Africa to make it internationally. And therefore, to have that role model, yes, it would have been slightly better if Jabeur had won. But she's a Wimbledon finalist. And for me, that's why I mean what I mean about the significance for tennis. Because she can be a role model that can inspire youngsters to put tennis first when they're good at maybe three or four sports at the age of 10.
Well, I think one of the most important things about Ons Jabeur that I think is significant is that she was inspiring kids from a very young age when she started playing as a junior. And there was a lot of tension on her as a junior. And I think also what's really important is she had opportunities to go outside of Tunisia to develop her tennis, whether it was in America or other parts of Europe or wherever. But she decided to go back to Tunisia and train there because that's where she wanted to be. That was her home. And I think that's even more inspiring because she did it from her home and she wanted to stay there. And that is just another example is that it can be done from there. You don't have to go somewhere else outside of that region in the world to be successful. And I think that sends a very profound message.
Well, you can get all the final results of Wimbledon, not just the five main draws, but the juniors, wheelchair, legends, etc., from the Wimbledon website. And speaking of wheelchair tennis, why not check out our podcast channel on Spotify or TuneIn, where you'll find a fantastic interview that Candy Reid did with the Dutch wheelchair tennis inspiration and newly crowned Wimbledon champion, Deirdre de Groot. Coming up next, we'll take a look back over the rest of the draw and also hear from Cam Norrie's coach, Facundo Lugones. And we check back in with John Newcombe, who speaks from the heart about another great from Australia who will be honoured this coming week.
On iTunes, Spotify, TuneIn and ATPTour.com, this is the ATP Tennis Radio Podcast.
You're listening to the ATP Podcast with Jill Krabers, Peter Mercato and me, Chris Bowers, as the dust finally settles on Wimbledon 2022. In fact, let's look back now on some of the other talking points across the Wimbledon Championships, starting with Rafael Nadal. Great achievement of his to beat Taylor Fritz, but then he couldn't play his semi-final, which of course left people who'd paid good money for semi-final tickets with one match short. Now, does that create any ethical issues? I tweeted about that wonderful match that Tom Gorman played in the Masters in 1972 against Stan Smith, where he retired at match point because he knew his back would not allow him to play the final. Is that from a bygone era? Is that the kind of thing that should happen these days?
I don't think so. I think, particularly Nadal, we might as well just use Nadal as the case study here. Whenever he walks out onto the court, he believes that he is going to win. One thing I will say is if he had stepped onto that court against Nick Kyrgios, it's with the full belief that he was going to go out there and win the match, because that's just the way that he plays. If he knows he's going to be below par or not be able to get through the match, it's probably sensible. But, you know, I actually like Taylor Fritz's outlook on it. He said, well, you know, I should have beaten him. Yeah, you know, if I had won the match, it would not have been a problem. But I didn't win the match.
And it was a problem.
And he played brilliantly, and now we're in this situation. I don't believe in that sort of shortchanging everything like that. He played to the absolute best of his abilities. He managed to win. He won fair and square. And, okay, he couldn't front up the next. But the other thing, too, is that this is all so rare. It very rarely happens. I mean, if there was a spate of these things going on, then that might be an issue. But really, Jill, this is a really isolated case. And he had to be really, really injured for him not to be able to play.
Well, that's exactly right. I agree. I mean, Nadal's going to go out there and wanting to compete to the best of his ability. And as a professional athlete, as a competitor that he is, one, it's hard to retire from a match. I mean, no athlete wants to retire from a match. It's one of the worst decisions you have to make. And that's why he was willing to stay out there and try and try. And he didn't find out till after how severe it was. I mean, it's a 7-millimeter tear that he has. And from that point on, you're thinking, okay, that could get a lot worse. And I don't think, he obviously didn't know it was a tear to begin with. So he's playing through it. And the fighter that he is, and he's played through so much pain his entire career. So he knows how to do it, knows how to manage it. I totally agree with Taylor Fritz. I mean, that has happened before. Well, if I just won the match, if I had, you know, been able to get through that match, then it's on me to be able to get through that and play in the next round. It's very unfortunate. We didn't have the Nadal Kyrgios semifinal. I know everyone was looking forward to that battle. But that's how it goes. And I think Nadal at the end, once he saw what the injury was, he's like, okay, I don't think I'm going to be able to get through two more rounds, and I don't want to make it worse. So
okay.
it's a tough decision.
Sure. And you're right, it is rare. There was the ATP Finals in 2014 when Federer couldn't take to the court, so Djokovic won on a default. There was a final in Miami once, didn't Ivanišević wake up with a shoulder, a neck problem, and he actually tried for three games and then gave up at Love 3 against Agassi. So it is fairly rare that that happens. But what would you say to a tennis fan who says, you can lose in the last round of qualifying and you get in as a lucky loser, so why shouldn't you get in as a lucky loser in the semifinals?
Oh, come on. Really? Is that an actual point? Is that being floated around? That you could actually lose the match to win a title?
No.
You mean, like, allow Fritz to play? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, so that Fritz could have played on Friday against...
No.
No?
No. No. I mean, do you want me to expand that out to a sentence?
No.
Really?
We have a principle of a lucky loser. So why shouldn't that lucky loser come in for a marquee match where people have... I mean, the cost of tickets on that Friday were £210, which is, what, $300 or something? €250?
It goes against the whole spirit of... You know, actually winning matches, winning seven matches to win a major. You can't say, oh, I won six,
but
lost
Kyrgios
one.
If Kyrgios, you know, got to the final by only winning five matches, not six.
Well, the lucky loser is predicated on the fact that in that particular section of the draw, the tournament hasn't yet started. So if a player withdraws before the tournament starts, then they can be inserted in. I think it raises all sorts of ethical issues. Obviously, you know, with the rise of, you know, sports betting and everything like that, I mean, you know, it probably wouldn't happen at that particular stage, that particular level with those particular players. But that would have to permeate down through the levels too. You couldn't just say, oh, here at Wimbledon, we're going to do it a particular way, or at the US Open, or where, or the Masters 1000s. You know, you can't have one set of rules for that and everything else. I just think there's too many problems with that, and I think it's absurd.
I agree with you in terms of the integrity of the sport, but you have got a marquee match that just didn't happen.
Well, I sort of agree with Peter on this one, Chris. I'm sorry.
I know you want
to change our mind.
No, I don't. But I'm just floating it because this is a spectator sport.
I did see it was a topic of conversation after Nadal pulled pulled out. I did see that that was on Twitter quite a bit of a potential that could be something that might be considered. But I don't think so either. I think it's just that's how it doesn't happen that often. It's just so unfortunate that it happened at this stage of the tournament.
And where does this leave Taylor Fritz? Because it's happened before, hasn't it? He was he lost a five-setter against Djokovic at last year's Australian Open when Djokovic had the abdominal muscle tear. Has he got a problem putting away players?
Well, maybe with abdominal injuries, it seems to be the common theme. No, look, I don't think so. I think his evolution is coming along quite nicely, actually, from Taylor Fritz, considering he did beat Nadal earlier this year at Indian Wells. He's made a steady rise up the rankings, and I'm quite bullish. I mentioned in the last podcast that I'm expecting him to be in single figures in terms of his ranking by the end of the season. He's going to have a big hard court season. He's not the only player across these 10, 15 years that it has had trouble putting away the likes of Djokovic, Federer, Nadal, Murray. And he's not going to be the last either, I suspect, with the way things have been going. But for him, you know, obviously, he's got that disappointment of not actually beating Nadal and being able to move through. And he would have been, you know, also fancying his chances against Kyrgios, perhaps as well, even win or lose. But he's got to take some heart with the way he's been playing, because he's been able to consistently, particularly here on grass, string those wins together and put in some really solid performances. I mean, didn't really drop a set through the first week and a half.
Yeah, I agree. I think he's been very impressive. I think he's proven that he can beat those players on the big stage. I think a perfect example is what Peter just mentioned, the finals of Indian Wells. Nadal was injured then as well, had a fractured rib. He found out later, obviously wasn't 100%. Fritz actually wasn't 100% in that final either. He was struggling with something wrong with his foot, and so he was able to play a unbelievable final against Nadal in the desert. So I think he's proven himself. And I think what's important is that consistency. I think he's proven himself over and over again that he can play at that level throughout the tournaments and deep now into a slam.
Cameron Norrie did very well at this tournament. He got to the semifinals, his first semifinal at a major, having been best third round up to that point. Was this a breakthrough for him?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. The ability to do it at home on this sort of stage with this sense of anticipation and expectation too. Earlier in the tournament, it was very much the narrative around Andy Murray, and he's here. I don't think, you know, there would be very few who would have predicted him to go through and actually, you know, challenge right at the really business end. There'd be the theatre goers, I think, here who come along to the championships who wouldn't have heard too much about Cameron and his story. And I think it's been great that he's been able to tell that story and actually show the hard work has actually paid off. And to see these players actually making these breakthroughs, I mean, conceivably, you know, obviously it ended in the semi-finals this year, but he's a player that's going to be around for the long term, it looks like, and could be a consistent contender, not just here, but obviously, you know, US Open, Australian Open as well, in the years to come. And I think the narrative's going to change in terms of, you know, the players who could take on the likes of Djokovic and Nadal to who are the ones who are going to come through when Djokovic, Nadal, Federer all retire. Who are the next ones coming through? And he certainly has all the qualities and attributes to be one of those.
I think it's definitely a breakthrough. I think everything that Peter said, but the other thing I just want to add one more thing, because you said it so well, Peter, is the fact that he, coming into this, he not only being able to deal with home country, big slam, getting to the first semifinal, but the fact that he mentioned that he didn't think grass was his best surface, which I think his game is well suited to grass, but the fact that he went into this event with the mentality that he didn't really feel that comfortable on the grass was surprising to me, and he had to make some adjustments. And I think you learn more about your game that way, as well as having to adjust to different surfaces. And the way he was able to perform here, I think he really did up his level.
I love the comment that Djokovic made. He was talking about, well, Norrie came into the locker room with his own scales. We have scales in the locker room, but he brought his own, which shows how professional he is. And then Djokovic said, unless it means something else, which is a lovely little aside, but I think it was actually a compliment. Does that denote a very, very high level of professionalism to you, Jill?
I think so. I think it's all in the details. We can all agree. I think that there's not much separating a lot of the players. A lot of it comes down to just a point here and there. I think we've seen a lot of matches, in particular in this event, with Djokovic Sinner, five set, obviously Norrie. You know, there's been a lot of five set matches in this tournament in particular. So there's just fine-tuning certain things. And I think, you know, Djokovic has been kind of a role model in that area in particular, where everything is just so, everything has to be.
He said, I really appreciate that, because I do that myself.
Yeah. And so when you can find that edge that might work for you, I mean, who cares what everybody else thinks? If you're going to bring your own scale, if it works for you, then go with it.
But he also said he saw Norrie drop his focus a few times. I just wonder whether that is the area that Norrie still has to work on.
Potentially. I think every match is different. It might have been something that distracted him, but that's what it's up to the player to be able to take on those challenges. And there's going to be distractions out in the court all the time. I mean, you're not going to get away from that. That's something you cannot control, but you can control how you react to it and how you take on those challenges.
I just say one thing, though, that we need to be careful of with Cameron Norrie here at the championships, and that is the misappropriation of the Aussie, 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 oi, oi, oi to Norrie, 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 oi, oi, oi. That is particularly irksome for an Australian. I mean, I don't like it anyway, but the fact that you've taken that and rolled with it, oh, come on. I don't think I'm going to put up with that in the years to
this
come.
This is cultural appropriation, is it?
You've just taken something which has been highly successful for many years and adapted it over here. Well, I mean, look, there's...
I'll agree with you at one level. It is the most inane chant, I think, in world sports, so nobody should be praised for picking it up. But so to that extent, I'm with you, but I take exception to being lumped in with my countrymen on that one. It has been a big learning curve for Cameron Norrie, whose support team sported a number of Texas Christian University caps in his box over the past fortnight. That was where Norrie went to college and where he met the man who's become his trusted coach, the Argentinian Facundo Lugones. Lugones has been speaking with Candy Reid.
So many things. I could be here for 10 hours explaining everything. But yeah, basically consistency, learn from mistakes, don't think you know everything, ask questions, and stick to what you believe that is working, and keep doing it even in the tough times, and always try to improve in all departments.
When you make mistakes, are you quick to realize them?
Well, yeah, I mean, the quicker you realize, the better you can become. Some of them I realize pretty quick, other ones no, but I think it's important to look back and look at the things that worked and things that didn't, and be humble and maybe understand why they didn't work and why you were wrong, and try to fix it for the next time.
Everyone sort of deals with mistakes differently. How have you sort of grown in that department in the past?
Yeah, just maybe not get too desperate or like be too hard on yourself, as long as you can correct what went wrong, and just make sure the next time when you're in that situation again, you remember the lessons and you can perform better, whatever you need to be doing. But basically remember what you learn and be tough in those moments and make the right decision.
And all tennis players are very critical of themselves. It's easier to criticize rather than to give praise. Is that something that you and Cam Norrie have worked on?
Yeah, I think one of Cam's biggest changes was admitting things and realizing them and having honest conversation about what happened in the matches or outside the court, and being humble enough to recognize what he needed to work on and actually do it, not just say it and then forget about it. He was actually really good at working on some things that he needed to be better, and that's why he started making big jumps, because he was always more honest with himself and with the whole team and with everything, and obviously not making excuses was getting them a big edge over most other players, because it's pretty common to make excuses here on tour and not fix what was wrong.
So he sounds like a very affable guy, and that he can take criticism quite well and respond to it. Is that something that he has really worked on and got a lot better at, or is he always good at it?
I think he got a lot better. At the beginning, maybe he would get quite defensive or not take it personal, but not admit it. And now he's like, yeah, I think you're right, or I did that because of this, not making excuses and saying what happened. And I think that's also comes with maturity. He's way more mature now and takes things way better, and he knows it's for his best interest, and he fixes them, and he never makes the same mistake.
Can you get too critical sometimes? If you're really good at taking criticism, can it become too much, where you're always looking for something that's wrong rather than praising what's right?
Yeah, I think that's a good point, but I think, well, the philosophy I have, we don't focus a lot on what's going wrong. We focus a lot on what's going right, and we try to build from there, and we work a lot on his strengths rather than everything that's going wrong. So I'm not too critical of him, and only the things that I think that are really important to fix, but I'm always like to focus on what's going right and the things that are going to make him win matches.
When you first started out with him, I don't know if you recall how it was when you needed to give him some constructive criticism. Always when you're younger and you're just working with somebody, it's a little bit more difficult to work out the communication. Is that true of your relationship?
Yeah, but I think that's credit for Cam, because at the end of the day, he was the one deciding to have me as a coach. So he was actually very humble and very, very open to what I had to say. And I also had help from James Trotman and Devin Bowen that are involved, and maybe the tougher things that needed to be said, it was said by them. And so, but yeah, no, I never had a problem with that, and he's always really open and about that. But I think the most important is he was the one taking criticism for someone close to his age, and obviously nowhere near as good of a tennis player as he is, so that's pretty good from him.
I presume as a coach it's easy to deal with your player when they've won, but what about when they've lost? Do you tend to leave Cam for a bit, or do you chat right away? Does it depend on the circumstances?
Well, yeah, I think it's more up to him when he comes off the court. If he wants to chat about the match, I'm ready. Always, I want to say so many things right after the match, but it's not the time, because if he's not open or if he's pissed off, he's not even going to remember. So whenever he's ready for a conversation, we have it. Usually we talk a little bit after the match, and then the next day we talk more, and we kind of go through the match more in depth. And when next time we get on the court, we try to make sure that we work on some things that needed to be done and other things that went well. And yeah, that's kind
of. And of course, you know him so well that that's probably easy for you to read. So a lot of it comes back to communication and how well you know your player.
Yeah, sometimes you're watching the match and you kind of know what's happening or what is going wrong, but obviously from the stands it's super easy to see and to have an opinion, but out there it's not easy at all. So you have to understand why he's not able to produce his level to do the things we thought he was ready to do. And I think that's kind of the question, you know, how do you can get him to those things and get out of those tough moments or snap out of a rough start or getting tired during a match and be ready to go back to what you were doing and to play your level. I think that's, and I think he Cam got a lot better at that, of finding his way into matches or staying more calm in difficult moments throughout the match that before maybe he would never be able to go back to what he was doing.
I read in an article that you said you've got a chip on your shoulder and you're always looking to improve. Can you explain that?
Well, yeah, that sounds a bit too much, maybe a chip on my shoulder. But yeah, I mean, obviously I have a lot of learning to do because I didn't play on the tour. So obviously that's a big plus if you're a coach, if you have that experience, and I don't have it. And so I'm always trying to work extra hard and learn new things and kind of like maximize my time on tour, and every day that I'm on site I'm trying to learn or talk to someone and just become a better coach.
Are there particular people that you learn from?
Yeah, actually a lot of coaches, especially the Argentinian ones that I'm really close with, good friends with Dante Bottini, Franco Lavina, I always talk a lot with him, and yeah, a lot of guys, and Esteban Carril, who used to work at the LTA and also went to TCU, I talked a lot with him. And yeah, most coaches are very, very open and very nice to me and always ready to help me.
Can you remember the best piece of advice you've ever received?
Yeah, always be one step ahead of your player. You always have to anticipate what the player wants and what he needs and what he's going to come up with, and you want to be ready for that.
What about your own learning and growth? Are you somebody who reads books, and you've said you speak to mentors, but are you just keeping learning and growing yourself?
Yeah, I'm not a big book reader. Actually, I read some books that Cam gave me, and I'm reading a little bit more now. But I like to, I follow a lot of like coaches from other sports, and I try to read their books or what they've done, and not just in tennis, but I like the coaching aspect of life a lot, so I try to stay updated with that and always see what other coaches are doing.
Is there a particular sport that you like to read about and coaches and their philosophies?
Yeah, a lot of basketball and rugby. I read about them and how they manage their teams and their leaders and what works in different teams, because obviously the same as players are not the same, teams are not the same. And yeah, I'm really interested in that.
And any particular basketball coach? Someone like Phil Jackson of the Lakers?
I read his book. I really liked it. I like a lot about Steve Kerr. And then rugby, I really enjoy the All Blacks one, Legacy. It's a really good book.
And what can you take from those kind of books? Because, like you said, it's a team event compared to an individual competition, but there's a lot of similarities.
Yeah, I think, well, so many different things, but I think the most important one from the Phil Jackson one is how to manage big stars and big egos and how to get the most out of everyone and also the other guys on the team, which is not easy. A lot of people think, oh, because you have the best players or you coach the best players, it's the easiest job, and sometimes it's way harder than people think, because you're dealing with a lot of egos and a lot of expectations, and that's not easy at all.
So it's harder to coach someone who's sort of in the top 20 and the expectations and the pressures are higher than someone outside the top 100. Would that be fair to say?
I think the pressure, yeah, is bigger because there's more room for failure, and there's always room for improvement, but not a lot. And you're obviously expected to do really, really well every week. And if you don't, everyone's going to be talking about the player and how he's not doing well, blah, blah, blah. So I think the pressure is a lot higher and the expectations are a lot higher, and that's the way it should be, and that's the most fun part, I think.
How do you deal with the pressure and expectations?
I just, obviously I have my own pressure and my own expectations, and Camps puts pressure on himself and his own expectations, but I think that's important to have, because that's what keeps you going and makes you wake up every day and make sure you're getting better, because you know the guy next to you or the guy behind you is working just as hard and he's going to take your spot. And that's kind of the pressure and the expectations that you need to deal with every day. And I think that's the most fun part, than being really, really all the way at the back and no one's trying to take your spot.
As a player yourself, when you're playing in college, you on the morning of a match, you get that adrenaline, don't you? The nerves, no matter what it is. Do you still get that as a coach ahead of a big match?
Yeah, I think maybe even more now. I think that's why I like it so much, because obviously the tournaments we're at and the competitions we're at, they're bigger than what I used to play. But yeah, the feeling is really similar, and I love it. It's like a drug.
You're listening to the ATP Tennis Radio Podcast.
Let's look at a few other players whose stock has risen over the past fortnight. Yannick Sinner?
I think, his stocks have risen. I think he's now transitioning into the big-time tennis, where he's going to be playing mid to deep second week, and certainly showed that on the way through here, that he can put in those sort of performances, and stocks are rising. Let me guess, Jill, stocks are rising, Yannick Sinner, in your opinion as well?
Absolutely. Look, he's one of my favorite. Actually, Sinner, Alcaraz, and Korda, who couldn't play, obviously, this event because of injuries, are three of my favorites that are upcoming. So the Sinner-Alcaraz match in particular, I was getting very excited about. And the way Sinner played in the match was outstanding. I thought he played exceptionally well. Another one, along with Norrie, who doesn't feel like he has a lot of grass court experience, doesn't necessarily feel like it's his best service, I felt like moved extremely well. I was very impressed with him. And
with Alcaraz or Sinner?
With Sinner. I'm Sinner.
Yep.
And I thought, obviously, with the match against Djokovic as well, going up two sets to love, my heart was wanting Sinner. I mean, Djokovic obviously coming through with that. But Sinner, I think, is definitely one that I believe is going to win some Grand Slams.
See, I thought that Alcaraz was going to beat Sinner.
I do too, but that's what's amazing.
And I would not have been surprised if it had been a really tight, say, five-setter or whatever.
I thought so too.
Thought for large sections of the match, Sinner completely outplayed Alcaraz.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
And that makes me wonder whether, in fact, Sinner is further on than I thought he was.
Oh, well, I thought I was always pretty high on him. So, yeah, I'm just ahead of you there, Chris. Sorry.
I wonder whether Sinner is actually the better player on hard courts and grass courts, and Alcaraz is the better player on clay.
But I think that's where I was going with what I was trying to say about Norrie as well, is when you have experiences like this on different surfaces, and obviously Sinner didn't have... And Alcaraz didn't actually have that much expectation coming into the grass because they haven't played a lot. So I think when you start to do better on a surface that you're not necessarily feeling like you're the best on, you start learning more about your game. And that can only be valuable to these young guys moving forward.
Let me throw three more names out there. Comment on them as you see fit. Christian Garin, Tim van Rijthoven and David Goffin.
I'll talk about Garin and Goffin. It's good to see both of them playing with confidence again. Garin in particular, I mean, he's had a tough time of it. Tennis player's favourite word, isn't it? Tough. Of late in terms of trying to recapture the form and try and recapture the motivation and everything like that. I think he's going to take plenty from this. David Goffin, obviously the injury issues have been well documented. To be able to string matches together at a major and feel like he belongs back up there, I think is wonderful for him. And I think, you know, this place can do remarkable things for players and their careers, and hopefully they can get some propulsion there. Van Rijthoven, great. See, he's out there now. We know his name. We know where he's been. He's had an immediate impact. It's whether he can continue that on through the hard court swing, but it gives him a nice little bit of propulsion to get him through the second half of the season.
Yes, I hadn't seen Van Rijthoven. I didn't see any of his matches in Sertogenbosch because that was the week after Roland Garros. I think I spent most of that week sleeping. But I love the way he plays. I'm just not sure how well his game will translate to slower surfaces.
Well, I think that's right. We have to watch him a little bit more. I mean, it's pretty impressive what he's done this last month. I mean, the fact coming through with a title, beating the number two player at the world in the time, and coming in here and backing up that performance. I think that's the key for him, is that he, you know, didn't expect anything, but to be able to come off of a huge win, a title that he didn't even expect to have, and to come back here in a Grand Slam and back up that performance was just exceptional.
I was looking forward to seeing I'm looking forward to seeing Garin playing. Like you, Peter, I'm very pleased to see him rediscover he was on such good form when the pandemic came, and he lost that momentum, and I think it's very important for South American tennis as well.
Absolutely. And just a word too on the Australian, Jason Kubler, who had a really good run, came through qualifying to advance his way through to the second round, reached the fourth round, and I think ran out of a bit of puff because he was playing Jack Sock, had a 5-set win over Sock, and then obviously came up against the informed
Taylor
Fritz.
He's got a great backstory, hasn't he?
Amazing. The fact that he spent
six surgeries?
Yes, and it's, you know, a hereditary kind of thing. But, you know, for a long time he was exclusively playing on clay because that's the only surface that wouldn't give him an injury. And it's good now that he's finally getting a chance to show what he can do, and he did that during this tournament.
Well, it's been some fascinating results, and we look forward to seeing how all the players who did well and less well do in the coming months. Before we go, there's just time to turn our attention back to one tennis pairing who've certainly got the winning habit, at least on court. Another great showing in the doubles tournament for Nikola Mektić and Matej Pavic, who reached the Wimbledon final 1 year on from going all the way to the title. So it's fair to say that, as you're about to hear, their playing prowess is a lot better than their ability at quizzes.
Okay, so we've got a trivia challenge and you're going to be competing against each other.
Nikola Mektić and Matej Pavic.
So the theme for your questions is the grass court season.
I think I'm going to win. We'll see.
Okay, first question. Not including Wimbledon, do you know which is the oldest grass court tournament? Nikola?
Queens.
Yeah. 1-0.
Really?
Didn't move, Matej.
Really?
Just taking my time. Easy question. Actually, I wouldn't even count this as a point.
It's okay.
Okay, which player has the most grass court wins of all time?
Pete Sampras.
It's not Pete Sampras.
Connors.
Yes, 2-0. Ready for you to come into this, Matej. Which player has the best win percentage on grass? Yeah, Matej?
Roger.
It's correct, Roger, on this one. Matej's on the board.
I gave this one to him.
I know.
It was obvious, right?
It's too easy.
It was obvious that I gave it to him.
Want to make it a fair fight? Who has won the most singles titles on grass in the Open era?
Federer.
Roger Federer, yep, correct.
Too many hollers, man.
Roger Federer!
Which doubles player has won the most grass court titles? Is that a racket raise?
Yeah.
It's a twitch or a raise?
I'm going to try with Todd Woodbridge.
Yes! Matej, this is not going so well for you. How many ATP tournaments are currently played on grass? Yeah, Matej?
Six.
No, it's not six.
Eight. don't know. It doesn't even matter because I'm going to win in the end. So.
Remembering the Isner Mahou match in 2010 at Wimbledon, how long was it?
11 hours, 22 minutes.
Really close. Do you want to have one go? And we'll see who gets closest.
11 hours and 41 minutes.
It was 11 hours, 5 minutes. So we'll give that one to Nicola. Yeah. Okay, who was the oldest player to win the Queen's Club tournament? Matu?
Feliciano Lopez.
Yes.
But he's your favorite player, so this doesn't count.
He's not. But he's cool. Feli's cool, especially in grass.
How many players have completed the Queen's Club Wimbledon double?
Andy's one. And I'll just go with Andy.
Well, he has done it, but there's a few more.
Did Pete done it?
Pete's done it, yeah.
John McEnroe?
Yep.
Connors?
Yep.
Rafa.
Rafa won Queen's.
Couple more to get, I think Australia.
Huge.
Pat Cash.
I think there's one that we're missing.
Who?
Boris Becker.
Oh, Boris Becker.
Boris Becker.
Do you remember which year did Wimbledon Centre Court get a roof?
Ooh, that's a good question. I will go with 2016.
No, I'd actually go with 2017. No.
It was 2009.
Why are we that bad?
Last one. Which doubles player has the most Wimbledon titles?
Woodford.
No. Same guy.
Woodbridge.
His partner.
I didn't do so well.
How would you rate that, Matteo?
Terrible, just like my fantasy NBA this year. It's not good.
Are you good at your own stats?
That's also a good question. Maybe next time you should do that. Let's see.
Yeah.
Let's see if it's gonna be any better.
I probably know his stats better than him.
Probably, yeah.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Nikola Mektić and Matej Pavic proving that not all things tennis come easy to them. But that was great fun, and thanks to the ATP Uncovered team, and in particular Kate Flory, for putting that together. And talking of great fun, next week we bring you a podcast special, as I was lucky enough to sit down with one of the game's great entertainers, Mansour Bahrami, to talk tennis tricks and international politics. His career was set against the backdrop of some pretty dramatic events in the 1970s and 80s. It's a great listen, so be sure to tune in for that. Before we go, congratulations to Leighton Hewitt, who'll be inducted into the International Tennis Hall of Fame this coming week. 1 year late because of COVID, but nonetheless, he will get his blazer. Hewitt was the US Open champion in 2001, the Wimbledon champion in 2002. He won the ATP Finals title and was world number one for the whole of 2002. Peter? An Aussie great?
An absolute Aussie great too, and don't forget an Australian Open finalist too along the way in 2005. And what he did for Australian men's tennis cannot be underestimated. The Davis Cup wins along the way. He's obviously a proud Davis Cup player. He's now the Davis Cup captain. Inspired people to pick up a racket and play the sport, and he has got a great reverence. He loves the older players, the Australian players that have from years gone by, and has that great respect and wanted to continue a lot of the traditions that brought the success. And he got the absolute best out of him. I remember him playing in Adelaide as a 15-year-old or 16-year-old.
He won the title at 16.
And he won the title. And it was just incredible. We thought, oh, this guy. But it was a thing of, for all of the titles, it was the hard work to get to that stage. And he never sort of, you know, just gave up on a training session or anything like that. An out-and-out champion that got the absolute best out of himself.
Jill, Leighton Hewitt is going to your home state of Rhode Island.
I know. I'm very excited. I always get very excited because a lot of people don't know that much about Rhode Island. Of course, we know International Tennis Hall of Fame, so I get very excited. I grew up 10 minutes away from the Hall of Fame. But I'm excited for him because I watched him a lot, obviously, before I started having a little bit more success and being around the tour, and so I got to see him a lot. But absolute unbelievable work ethic, and I think that's what's so inspirational about Hewitt. I mean, he just fought so hard, and that's what you remember about him, his passion for the sport, and the fact that I feel like at the end too he struggled to give it up, because he after he maybe didn't announce his retirement, but played doubles after for a few times. And you could just see his heart still out there all the time, just wanting to compete. And that's what is so ingrained in him, is that work ethic. And that, to me, is huge inspiration.
The words of Jill Krabus, and before her, Peter Mercato. And as you heard earlier in the show, I also managed to speak to the great John Newcombe, who gave Leighton Hewitt his Davis Cup debut as a teenager. So obviously the discussion couldn't pass without me getting Nuke's views of the latest Hall of Fame inductee.
Couldn't be more excited for him. I've sent a video message to him. I can't be there myself, but he's very deserving of it. And Leighton's doing a great job today as the Australian Davis Cup captain. You see him sometimes. He's out there at midday watching one of the boys playing, and there he is watching one of the other boys playing at night. So his heart's in the right place. He doesn't need the money. He's doing it because he loves doing it. And it was a joy to have got to know Leighton as he grew up. I first saw him play when he was 10 years of age in Adelaide, and then when he was 14, he came to my tennis ranch in Texas, and he came with three other players from Australia and a coach to play a month of tournaments over there. And the first week he came up to me and said, I'd like to interview you. I said, what for? He said, well, I'm doing a school essay, and I'd like to interview you for it. I said, great. So when do you want to do it? He said, well, I'm ready now. And he had 25 questions all written out, very professional, and we did the interview. And he was 14 then, and it was a little over a year later when we picked him as a junior player in the Davis Cup team, and when we played France at White City.
Is this what you call the Orange Boy?
Well, we call them the Orange Juice Boy. That dated back to Harry Hopman days, and I went through it, and Roche went through it. We all went through it. The team would be playing and practicing all day, and you'd be in the dressing room squeezing oranges. So we developed really strong wrists and no automatic squeezes, and we were called the Orange Juice Boys. So that's what Leighton became. But he didn't squeeze much orange juice because he was so intense in his practice that Pat Rafter, who was our number one player, he wanted to practice with Leighton all the time because of the intensity of the practice session.
What did you first notice about him when you brought him in as a fully fledged player to the Australian Davis Cup team for what was the centenary tie against America?
That was pretty interesting because he'd been for 18 months the sort of the third singles player, and so he was travelling in the team, but Philippoussis and Rafter were playing the singles, and we were at Wimbledon, and he's Darren Cahill, his coach, and his dad came to me and said, look, we've been on the road for, you know, sort of 5 months, would you mind if Leighton missed this next tie against the US in Boston? And he could go home and have a rest. And I said, yeah, actually I do mind, because that's the centenary match. It's a very important match, and I think Leighton should be there, but he's got time, so why doesn't he go home for a week and then come over to Boston, and so he can be there for like 5 days before. And they said, okay. So off he flew to Australia. Well, the very next day, Philippoussis injured his knee in a match against Sampras at Wimbledon, and Leighton landed in Adelaide, and I was on the phone. I said, mate, how was the flight? He said, oh, yeah, good, thanks. I said, good, well, you've got 2 days to rest, then I want you on another plane back to Boston, and 'cause you're playing. And that was it.
He loved it, I bet.
he came out of the blocks in the first match playing Todd Martin, who was number 9 in the world, and he blew Todd away. You know, it was just a joy to sit on the side of the court. I mean, of course he had nerves, but the more nervous he got, the better he played.
It's easy to look at Hewitt's career in terms of his two Grand Slam titles, US Open 2001, Wimbledon 2002, but he went the whole of 2002 at world number one. And given that he didn't have a big stroke, given that his big weapon was his speed around the court and the fact that he got everything back, that's a phenomenal achievement.
Yes, it was. And, you know, in hindsight, looking back, perhaps he should have concentrated on developing a few one or two more weapons, just to take away the pressure of having to, you know, scamp around the back of the court and turning defense into offense. But he still did fantastically well, and of course Roche and I didn't have much to do with his game after he won those things, because we'd retired as Davis Cup captain and coach. But he still did wonderfully well and continued a great record in Davis Cup and got through. But by the same token, along came Roger Federer, and the game became more and more powerful.
My thanks once again to John Newcombe. And Leighton Hewitt's induction takes place at the end of the grass court tournament in Newport, Rhode Island, as the focus of the tennis circuit now returns to the ATP Tour. Thanks also to Peter Mercato and Jill Krabus for joining me on this week's podcast, and indeed Nikola Mektic, Matej Pavic and Facundo Lagunas for their contributions. I'm Chris Bowers. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the tennis.